Hey, what's up, y'all? Welcome to Men Thrive, the podcast where we are committed to black men showing up whole, operating in joy, and living with power. My name is Jeff Johnson. I'm joined by Kevin Dedner, my co-host and founder of Men Thrive. And we're excited to be here with you today. What's up, Kev?
Good afternoon, Jeff. How are you?
Man, listen. Life is good. The check cleared. My wife likes me today, and the kids ate.
Always good when the check clears.
And sometimes I actually take my wife liking me today first, because the check is clear and she not like me, and it's a bad day.
Yeah. So no food in the pantry.
Listen, we're excited. We are really blessed with the brothers that are willing to come through. And have a conversation with us. For those of you that are wondering why men thrive, because we recognize so often that black men are in this place where they are grinding to survive. And we recognize that grinding should never be the perpetual goal. Building should be, and that survival should never be our aspiration, but thriving should be. And so we're thankful for the brothers that come through to talk about what they're building and how they're thriving, and how mental health in particular plays into both. And today is no exception. We've got with us, this brother is an author. He is a producer. He is a director. He is a creative. He is a father. He is a social architect. He is the manifestation of power, and I'm so excited that he has come through. Brothers and sisters, no other than Shaka Singor. What's up, brother?
Man, how's it going, man? Thank you for the warm welcome, man. I felt like a boxer about to come into the ring to Larry Pepper, man. I'm like, yo, you come out, bring me out on stage from here on out.
Brother. Oh, listen, hey, man, you first of all, you know, man, if you want to, all I do is get in the booth and record it, man.
And, absolutely.
And we can get a producer to put some music over it, and we'd be in business.
Man, let's do it.
But no, man, so there are a number of people who know your story. There are a number of people who have had the benefit of reading Righting My Wrongs, where you go into detail about your own story, being convicted of murder, going into a facility. Within that facility, being put into solitary confinement for longer than any human should ever be in solitary confinement for, was it 6 years?
Yeah, total. I did a total of 7 years throughout the 19 years I was incarcerated.
Mm-hmm. And that you never let that define you, even there. And so your writing and your ability to transcend beyond those bars and those walls was what attracted a number of people to your story. But your purpose has been so much larger than that. And so I wanted us to spend some time in this episode, Shaka, talking about just the theme I am, and how many brothers are struggling with identity. And as a result of struggling with identity, they're struggling with wholeness, having a difficult time even living in a space of gratitude and joy because they're becoming what someone else wants them to be versus who they were created to be. And as a result, they are giving other people power versus living in their own. And so I'm curious, brother, can you for a second share with us who is Shaka Singor now, and who was Shaka Singor when you went into that facility?
You know, I mean, the way I see it is, you know, as a father, which is like the most important title I've ever held. You know, being a thought-evolved man has been super important to me. And when I mean thought-evolved, I mean in the most holistic way, being able to, you know, just have those mental check-ins where it's like, okay, am I living in my divine purpose? are the things that I'm doing today serving not only my personal growth and development, but creating space for my son to evolve to the fullness of his being as a young man. You know, my son's 8 years old. And it's really important to me to be aligned with that inner purpose in a way that is organically transferred to him and to the other young men and women that I mentor throughout the country. And, you know, in this moment right now where we're dealing with this pandemic and, you know, people feeling anxiety being quarantined, you know, I look at it as like one of those moments of real check-in, you know, being able to go back and look at that little boy, you know, something that really resonates. And, you know, we have these conversations often is how we don't just allow space for little boys to be little boys. You know, I was probably considered an adult by the time I was 11 years old. And what I realized on my journey through prison is that I had never given myself permission to just be a little boy. And all the brain science points to the development of our brain not reaching adulthood until we're 26.
Yeah, right.
And so I went to prison when I was 19 years old. And at that time, what I recognize now is that, you know, I was a broken little boy that came from some broken circumstances that led me down that path. And what I was fortunate, you know, to have in my experience was being introduced to incredible men, men who had found their own purpose, men who understood that within that purpose was the responsibility of reaching other young men in that environment and ensuring that when we return to our communities, we return as assets instead of liabilities. And so, you know, today, you know, I'm coming up on 10 years of freedom. And, you know, I got a range of accomplishments, of, you know, shelves full of awards and accolades and all the things for the work I've done out of here. But the most important thing for me is when my elders from prison call me and say, son, we're proud of you because you were a man of your word and that you came home to add value to the community as opposed to take away value. So, you know, I'm complex. You know, I'm still growing. I'm still on this path of growth. You know, I just got a therapist, which has been amazing to help me even unpack the 19 years of incarceration and the 10 years of struggling to reacclimate to society. You know, so I'm funny. I wake up laughing. I wake up in a spirit of gratitude. I try to find, you know, a few things to be thankful for to start my day. Usually they're very simple things. Like I'm excited to have clean socks. And, you know, I know that it's a blessing to, you know, have toothpaste and, you know, to be able to drink some fresh orange juice. Like it's amazing to me, you know, still to this day. So, you know, I'm all the complexity that make up being a human being. But for the most part, I'm really purposeful.
Let me ask you something, Shaq. I mean, I want to talk about this journey towards therapy. But before that, because a lot of brothers are committing to a level of self-work before they've given themselves the freedom to do therapy. You talked about meeting some real men and promising those men what you would do when you were back in the world. What was your process, though? And you know, not in a detailed way, but as you think about some of the things that this 19-year-old kid was forced to do to ensure that his identity wasn't rooted in his jacket, but to your point, was predicated on a larger purpose. And you probably know better than me how many people in and outside have their whole identity wrapped up in the worst thing they ever did.
Absolutely.
Versus who they've been created to be. And so I'm wondering, what was that process for you, brother, where even in the midst of all of this stuff that I'm forced to now deal with, that you, prior to ever being released, had redefined who Shaka Singor was. And what was the process for that?
Yeah, so it was a three-step process that I discovered along the journey of growth. The first thing was acknowledgement. Like, I had to acknowledge that I had hurt my community. I had hurt people in my community. I had devastated a family. Also had to acknowledge the things that had been done to me from the time I was, you know, a little child. You know, the abuse at home, the, you know, the exploitation within the street culture as a kid. The second thing was apologizing. Like, I had to apologize to people who I had caused harm to, but also had to apologize to myself for accepting a narrative that had nothing to do with me. Mm. And then the final thing was atonement. You know, I knew that getting out of prison, it was important to me to be in service based on my experience to my community, and largely because there's this idea about repaying your debt to society. And when I was in prison, I was never in a prison in my community. I was in these rural prisons, way up north, you know, tucked away in these areas that had nothing to do with where I came from. And so I knew the real atonement was going to take place when I got released and I began to be in service to the community, but also had to atone with myself because I, despite all the circumstances, there were still decisions I made that was harmful to me. And how I arrived at those three things was through this process of asking a tough question. I was in solitary and I got a letter from my oldest son. He's my oldest son now. His mother had told him why I was in prison, you know, and I didn't have the, you know, privilege of being able to have that conversation with him. You know, his mother shared it before I can talk to him. I didn't know what the context was, but it made me stop and ask this question about how. Like, how did I go from an honor roll scholarship student with dreams of being a doctor to serving out my most promising years in solitary confinement? And so I began to journal and I began to unpack all the things that was ever said to me, ever done to me, and I began to reassign the responsibility to other people who were actually responsible, as opposed to internalizing it as if I was somehow, as if I had somehow brought these things on me. Mm. And it was so liberating to recognize that the abuse at the hands of my mother, you know, the exploitation in the streets, like, those were choices that they made to a kid. And I had to acknowledge the child that I was and to love on that person, you know. And so that began a journey towards self-healing and became the guiding force that allowed me to return to the community as an asset, you know, as opposed to a liability. And I wouldn't have got there, man, if it wasn't for, you know, the elders I speak of. You know, oftentimes we hear people talk about OGs and, you know, everybody's an OG now. And, you know, the culture I grew up in, like, you know, in order to be an OG, you had to actually have been within the culture that create gangsters. Cause that's what OG means, original gangster. But an OG is a gangster that recognized the error of their ways. And then they use their wisdom to guide young people to a deeper purpose that doesn't include, you know, incarceration or early death. And so I was fortunate just to have real OGs who blessed me with books and challenged me to read, man. And we would debate, you know, the content of the books because they wanted to make sure I wasn't just reading it, but I was fully comprehending and able to communicate it to the other young brothers who I was responsible for. Mm.
Yeah, this is Kevin. I was just thinking about this process you just lined out. And I really think that's a powerful process that anyone can take themselves through to sort of reconcile anything that's happened in their life. Can you talk a little bit more about that process and speak to it as if you're giving advice to someone who needs to revisit something that has happened in their life?
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for asking that. I get that a lot. And, you know, one of the things, I'm a big hip hop fan. So anytime I hear like bars from artists that just resonate with me, I'm like, oh, that's the thing right there. And there was a point in Jay-Z's 444 album when he said, you can't heal that which you don't reveal. And what I know from growing up in my community, I'm from Detroit, and, you know, I grew up in a pretty tough neighborhood, tough background, is that oftentimes we just, you know, suppress things that have transpired in, you know, in our lives, and largely because there's guilt associated with saying, mama, you was wrong, or dad, you was wrong. You know, we tend to uphold things in our community that's unhealthy just because that's the way that they've been handed down. So what I would say is, like, the acknowledgement piece was about me. It was about nobody else. It wasn't about, you know, putting the blame on anybody else. It was just saying, hey, these things happened, and these were real things. And, you know, you can't grow into the fullness of your being without acknowledging the things that have hurt you. And so that part was super important. And, you know, the other part of it was, it's a duality there. You know, I have been hurt. You know, I believe that hurt people. And in order to disrupt that cycle, I also had to acknowledge that I have really hurt some people. I had devastated people, let people down. You know, I forfeited my responsibility as a father. And then to apologize in a meaningful way, you know, I think it's Charlemagne the God says that, you know, the best apology is change behavior. And so what I would say is, you know, being able to change the behavior, being able to acknowledge, hey, you know, these things were hurtful, they were harmful, and I refuse to do them anymore. You know, I had this epiphany when I was sitting in a cell. There was an officer that came to my cell door, and he demanded a strip search. And I just refused, you know. And, you know, he rifled off a whole bunch of consequences for my refusal. But at that time, I was in solitary. And I'm like, you know, at worst case scenario, y'all can come in and kill me, because y'all basically have already tried to kill my soul. But in that moment, what I recognized that intellectually, he was inferior to me. In most capacities, he was inferior to me. But yet here he was controlling my life. And I said to myself, I would never participate in any behavior that would allow somebody that inferior to me in intelligence and culture and communication to be in control of my life. And so that helped change the behavior. And then just the acknowledgement part was helpful in me recognizing that if I continue down a path that led to more harm in my community, then I wasn't being the you know, the full man that I was capable of being. And so, you know, that was important. And then the atonement, you know, when you're in service to others, and like now is a great time to be in service to other people. And you know, to me, it brings us back to community. It brings us back to how we're really divinely designed to coexist with each other, is when we're in service of each other in whatever capacity, whether it's, you know, parental, or whether it's as, you know, the child of aging seniors, or just somebody in the community that says, hey, I want to be a helping hand. Mm-hmm. And like those three things, I find are just amazing guiding points through life. And, you know, it's just something that I try to wake up and figure out, how can I be in service? What are the things that I need to acknowledge that's going on inside of me? And it, are there things that I need to apologize? And it doesn't always have to be like these big, serious, deep, you know, sometimes being insensitive or being thoughtless in behaviors is being able to catch that and say, hey, you know what? That caused my friend some hurt. Let me figure out how I can rectify that in a way to where they understand that I'm going to treat them differently this go around. Mm-hmm. And I'll be a lot more sensitive and a lot more thoughtful about our engagement.
You talked about, I want to come back to this, where you are with therapy, but you said something about this time and this virus and what it is creating by way of social and economic instability and insecurity. And there are a lot of ways to serve, right? I mean, there's a ton of brothers right now navigating a social isolation. That's not always helpful for cats who already don't even know how to connect. And one of the things you do really well, Shock, is bring folks together, whether it is in the community through the the content that you curate or whether it's at your home with the experiences you curate. What would you say right now to brothers who are navigating a level of social isolation? What would be some of the things that you would recommend so that this time could be one that's positive versus one that has to be negative?
Yeah, no, thank you for asking me that. Recently I wrote a piece. I was, you know, I was sitting there and I was just listening to, you know, the anxiety. One of the things about this moment specifically that's causing people the most anxiety is not knowing when it's going to end. Mm-hmm. Not having a definitive point of saying, okay, 30 days from now, here's where we'll be in the world. And when I thought about that, like, I mean, it emotionally moved me. And I was like, okay, what did I learn from being in solitary that applies to this moment right here? Mm-hmm. And I realized that part of the mental challenge of being in that environment is you have an indefinite sentence, meaning that they never tell you when you're going to get out.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the first 2 years of my last stretch. So my last stretch was 4.5 years, 23-hour lockdown. And I remember when I would hear the officers or, you know, the counselor coming by the door, I would get this anxiety and say, you know, and be like, yo, is this the day? Is this the day they're going to let me out? And I realized in that moment, you know, that I couldn't control what they did. I could only control how I reacted to what they did. And once I accepted that, you know, the anxiety lessened. I began to focus on what I can do within that cell to better myself. So I read a lot. You know, I highly encourage people to read books during this time. I did a lot of journaling. I think this is a great opportunity for people to really get in touch with who they truly are as opposed to who they think they are. You know, a lot of what's been taken from us is part of the way we've identified ourselves with this employment. You know, we think about ourselves through, you know, the jobs that we're doing that pay the bills, that provide the house and the cars and et cetera. But when you strip all that away, you still have you.
Absolutely.
And that's why it's so important to just, you know, to journal, being able to reach out to others. You know, our brother, DJ D Nice, he just did something incredible.
Man.
Where, you know, he's playing music from his home and he's bringing people together. So being of service into others based on your talent and your gift, whatever that is for you. And it could just be right there in your neighborhood, going out, cutting somebody grass and, you know, obviously being safe and wrapped up and gloves on and things like that. But it's so many people who can use the voice of men who are evolving in their thinking, evolving emotionally and mentally. And those are some of the things that, you know, in the right now, start an online book club. I'm actually thinking about starting one myself, you know, or just attending book clubs since I'm a writer and, you know, letting my, you know, people who follow my work ask questions and things of that nature. But online,
let me know because I'm going
to
join that book club.
Huh?
I said, let me know because I'll join you in the book club.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I just think online provides us a great opportunity to really connect, to really use that platform, you know, because I mean, imagine this world without us being able to be connected in some capacity digitally. It'll be a lot more chaotic and Absolutely. A lot more uncertain. So I just think every little bit matters. You know, it doesn't have to be, you know, 100,000 people at a dance party online. You know, it can be as simple as getting a group of 5 to 10 people together and saying, hey, let's just talk about how we're feeling right now. You know, how can we best support each other? You know, how can we make each other laugh? Like, laughter is one of the greatest medicines during anxious times. You know, in prison, you know, the jokes are abundant, you know, because, you know, you can't survive hell without the ability to laugh at, you know, the absurdity of it all.
Yeah. The advice you just gave is so practical for everyone. And one of the things, I just want to go back to the very beginning of your 3-step process and the acknowledgement. And it also picks up a theme that I've heard in the conversation about us normalizing things that have happened to us that are unhealthy or, you know, we just think it's part of our experience. And Jeff, you and I have had this conversation before when we talk about the ACE score.
Mm-hmm. And that's the, for those of you who are not aware of this score, it's called the Adverse Childhood Experience Score. And it's a set of questions, 10 questions that you can take online, and it helps you realize all of the traumatic experiences you may have had growing up. And I think as a, you know, sort of blending that with your advice in this time, you know, it's a good time to reflect on things that we've experienced, you know, and what we can do to move on beyond those experiences. But more importantly, what is it that we're doing today as a result of that experience, and how we've found our way of coping with it because we never acknowledged it?
Yeah, no, I think that's great. And I, you know, I've studied ACEs, and, you know, and I think of it through the lens of a father. You know, I had this experience with my family where one day we were at my aunt's, and there was a few of my aunts and uncles around, and they were watching my son play. And, you know, that they just kept saying, man, he just reminded me so much of you. And, you know, his just this energy and things like that. And first it was flattering. And then I found myself so angry because I was like, if that's who I was, why didn't you protect me? Mm-hmm. You know, why was it okay for my mother to do the things that she did, and you were knowingly bearing witness to this, and you didn't step in to safeguard me from what was happening? And I realized that that was part of the cycle, is that we don't protect, you know, little black kids, black boys specifically. And in order to disrupt that pattern, like, I had to get in touch with the little boy that I was.
Absolutely.
So I had to think about, you know, as a father, what did I really need? And what did, not only what did I need, but what did I want, you know? And, you know, now today, you know, my son will come up and randomly, and he wants a hug. And, you know, and sometimes he just wants to cuddle on a couch and relax, because he's literally a little boy, and making sure that I'm creating space for that. And the toughest part is to be honest about, you know, the things that are hurtful in our community, like, and the trauma that's embedded so deeply in the community, you know, and a lot of it is trauma that happens within a household, because that pattern of corporal punishment, you know, the idea that if my child makes me upset, I beat them, as opposed to understanding what's really going on inside of me that actually has nothing to do with my child. Like, knocking over a bottle of water doesn't warrant a beating. And so one of the things that I've done since we've been in this, you know, sanctioned, you know, quarantine, is I created a parenting group on Facebook just randomly. I was like, hey, who want to join this group? And within minutes, it was hundreds of people in this parenting group. And it's just a free space, you know, it's a free space for parents to talk out their frustrations and talk out, you know, this disruption of what was their normal routine. Because when we don't get it out, it manifests in other ways. And typically, children become the victims of, you know, parents' anxiety and things of that nature. And I just try to, you know, help parents figure out different ways to communicate with their children that doesn't, you know, require beatings and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you this. I mean, talking to you, Shaq, it's almost like you have a bootleg degree in psychology. You've done a lot of self work. You've challenged and addressed and acknowledged a lot of your trauma. You've done some of that work. And so in doing all of that, what was the decision for you to seek therapy when, hell, man, you had done a lot more work than cats who had been in therapy? So what was going on when you decided, hey, I need to actually seek therapy despite all of the self-work that I've done, both inside and outside?
Yeah, for me, it was a couple of things. One is I recognize that my experience is vastly different from most people's life experience at the most extreme level, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I was shot when I was 17. I committed, you know, a crime that left, you know, a family devastated because I killed their loved one. And then I had a very tumultuous 19 years in prison, you know, the solitary confinement piece. And the reality is, like, nobody should bear that cross alone. And, you know, being strong for other people oftentimes makes us vulnerable in ways that doesn't always serve us best when it comes to ourselves. And, I mean, we know countless elders and ancestors who basically worked themselves in the ground trying to serve other people without really taking care of their inner being. And I really thought about it in the most simplistic way. I was like, you know, I have a really nice car. I get those annual checkups, oil changes, you know, same thing with the phone. Is, you know, I put the phone case on and make sure that's protected. And I'm like, the optimum time for me to seek, you know, therapy is when I'm actually operating at my best. You know, like I know what it looks like when it's really bad. And so for me, it's being proactive, you know, it's recognizing that it doesn't mean that there's something technically wrong with you or, you know, that you're somehow weak. And actually, to me, it's a strength, you know, to be able to say, hey, you know what? This shit right here is a little bit heavier than what I want to carry for the rest of my life. And I just need somebody to talk to that can get it without judgment. And in the sessions, man, I've been able to really unpack mostly the stuff that's happened since I've been home. You know, this was a different type of trauma coming out to a world that's very different from where I was at. And, you know, it may seem counterintuitive when you think about it, like, how can freedom be more traumatic? But the reality is I came home to a very different world. You know, it was 20 years later. Technology had went, you know, through the roof. I was stuck in, you know, the era that I came home from, but also came home to a relationship, like a real grown-ass relationship. But I went to prison when I was a boy. And, you know, so having being able to really sit with somebody who understands the things that I was experiencing, the PTSD that I hadn't dealt with. You know, I got shot 16 months later. I was incarcerated. You know, when I came home, I'm like, oh, that those old feelings came right back, you know? Yeah. And so being able to just be able to process that with somebody and talk it through and not just be in my head about it, like that was just really, really important for me.
Shaq, let me ask you this before we get out of here. Like you to me are an example of self-development and a commitment to mastery. You and I have had countless conversations about how you view writing and your writing skill. But the fact that you've committed to it in a way that even some professional writers have not. As you think about this moment where cats have time on their hands that, frankly, they never have had before and they may never have again, what would you say to brothers about how to utilize this uncertain moment as an opportunity for self-development and mastery?
Yeah, one of the things that I recognize just from, you know, being in so many different crisis-like experiences that within every crisis there's opportunity or a series of opportunities. And self-mastery is like one of the greatest opportunities we have in front of us right now. It's really stepping back and figuring out your why. Like, why was your life what it was prior to this quarantine? And what do you want it to look like moving forward? And what are the steps you can take? You know, as a writer, I realized that the writing process is to be writing something every day, no matter what it is, social media posts, if it's, you know, a text or whatever, like just a constant process. You know, process is everything. It's one of the things that a lot of us don't like to get to, is we just want to get to the end results. But as you and I discussed, you know, before, when I began writing, like, my goal was to become one of the best writers, period. Not just somebody who was good, who happened to be in prison, but, you know, I wanted to have my books embedded in the culture in such a way that, you know, 10 years from now, kids in colleges are reading my books. And that required being present enough to recognize where I was good at, but also to recognize where I needed to develop and to continue developing those things. I mean, you know, I just got a new book deal. I'm a New York Times bestselling author, and the book I'm reading right now is On Writing by Stephen King. So I'm still in the process of learning from the master storytellers and craftsmen of the trade. And I just think it's a great opportunity to, you know, get in shape, you know, get back in tune with our bodies, get in tune with our minds, get in tune with our spirits. You know, if you have a spiritual practice, being able to really spend time in that, you know, if you kind of got caught up in a hustle and bustle of day-to-day life, you know, do a couple of push-ups or walk around, you know, the yard or whatever it is that you can do to just be mobile. But these are opportunities that, you know, again, we're probably not going to have this type of time on our hands. You know, we got children, we got families, we got businesses, we got work. And it's going to be a rush of, like, everything once we come up off this quarantine. So, you know, I just say do what you can while you can and then recreate, you know, healthier habits through that process.
Man, Shock, we so appreciate you coming through, man. I hope that we can do this again. You personify our commitment, which is helping brothers show up whole, operate in joy, and live with power. And so we not only appreciate your presence on the show, but we appreciate your example because you never show up like you got it. You know it all. You show up just willing to give it all. And I appreciate that, man, in a real way. So thank you, brother.
Yeah, thank you.
Man, thank you all, brothers, for creating this space and this platform for us to really talk about the importance of thriving and to shift out of this survival mindset. And just a space for us to just be, you know, that's the biggest thing is, you know, brothers need to have space where we can just be, you know, whatever state of development we're in. So thank you for acknowledging that and for just creating a space. And thank you all for the great questions. Appreciate y'all.
Absolutely, man. Where can folks follow you, brother?
Folks can follow me on all social media at Shaka Sengor. Website is shakasengor.com. That's S-H-A-K-A-S-E-N-G-H-O-R across all platforms.
Y'all, you've been listening to The Incomparable. And I think I might do that recording for you, man. So whenever you want to use it, you got it. But we're so thankful for Shaka coming through and his work. Appreciate you all being a part of this community, where we truly are about, as Shaka said, challenging this notion that brothers should be grinding to survive instead of building to thrive. So you all listen. I mean, we don't profess to have all the answers, and we could have this conversation for a lot longer. And in fact, we should. But with Men Thrive, our goal is to not pretend like we have all the answers. It's to create a space for us to talk about these things in a way that, unfortunately, we just don't have a ton of platforms doing so. And so we thank you for joining us. We hope that you become a part of this community, so that when Black men show up whole and operate in joy and live with power, that it doesn't just affect Black men. It affects those that love them. It affects the communities they live in. It affects the places where they work. Because when all of us can show up with a level of wholeness, clarity about who we are, and strengthen our identity, when all of us can operate in a level of joy and gratitude and thanksgiving, when all of us can operate in power, then we find a world where we're not as mad. We're not as frustrated with each other. Even the differences that make us so uniquely wonderful seem less different and more like they are additives and accents that make the entire community better. And so for those of you that may not be Black men and wondering why in the hell are they just talking to Black men? It's not because we don't care about humanity. It's because so often the single group that has had humanity less bestowed upon them is brothers. And that's where we've decided to start in our service to humanity itself, not where it ends. So thank you for joining Men Thrive. We absolutely love you and hope that you love each other. We'll see you next time. Yo, thanks for listening to Men Thrive. Did you like us? If you like us, visit your go-to podcast provider and check out other episodes. And also go deeper by joining our community at menthrive.com.